This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The dangers of summer by today's standards. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
You've heard about the risks associated with grilling, but that's only part of a list of new perils. There are also warnings about things like corn on the cob.
Most banks are fairly boring places, but one CEO is trying to change our perception. Hear how.
The man who has traveled to more places around the world than anyone else, including 193 countries.
And the men who obsess over having the perfect grass.
Some of the wives say, why are you cutting the grass? It looks fine already. But yeah, a lot of them cut two or three times a week. One of the guys I talked to, he mows the entire surface twice each time he mows, just because he likes uniformity. And then if there's any rogue blades of grass sticking up, he'll pull them out by hand.
Wall Street Journal reporter Bob Haggerty found extreme cases of lawn care. He's here later in the hour. Well, there's a private school in the Washington, D.C. area that's getting quite a reputation. Current Supreme Court Justice Neil Gorsuch and new nominee to the court, Brett Kavanaugh, both attended Georgetown Prep in North Bethesda, Maryland. What sets it apart, aside from the $60,000 a year in tuition? Here's Wall Street Journal reporter Michelle Hackman. Michelle, what have you found?
There was a lot of talk about this school in Washington called Georgetown Prep because Judge Brett Kavanaugh went there. The previous Trump pick for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, is also a graduate. He graduated 2 years behind Kavanaugh. And another major Trump appointee, Jerome Powell, who's the Fed chairman, is also a graduate. And so this sort of got people in my newsroom thinking, is this a school that's sort of becoming the new famous school in Washington that's producing, you know, political big shots?
How about that? In addition to, I guess, the Ivy League schools, right, where most of these folks seem to come from.
Right. I think that the relevant comparison, especially in Washington, Washington prep schools, is Sidwell Friends. You know, that is typically the place where Democrats emerge from. You know, two Democratic presidents, Bill Clinton, Barack Obama, sent their kids there. So I think that's sort of thought of as very prestigious, but we've seen sort of a shift recently.
Is Georgetown Prep considered a conservative type school?
You know, I don't think that they would call themselves that. They are a Jesuit school, and I think, you know, from speaking to alumni, that the student body many years tends to lean slightly conservative just because of their Catholic upbringing. But I don't think that they would sell themselves that way. In fact, I think Jesuit teaching really emphasizes some sort of social justice themes, like, you know, helping the poor. So
what is it about this school then?
Well, I do think that there is a sort of large conservative Catholic population in Washington that sends their students there. You know, I've heard some people call it the Catholic elite. I don't know if I would necessarily use that term, but, you know, we've definitely seen a string of people come out of the school. And so the question arose, what was it about the school? You know, was it just the fact that this is where conservative families wanted to send their kids, or was it really the school's emphasis on service? And I think probably it's both of those things.
Wow. What's the curriculum like?
The curriculum is very rigorous, like most schools. I think what sets the school apart is that it really brings that Jesuit education to the fore. Every class begins with a prayer. Each Wednesday they have a process that they go through called Examine, where students are asked to be silent for 7 minutes and just sort of reflect on ways that they've been kind to others, things, you know, positive things that had happened to them, upcoming challenges. And so I think students are taught to be very reflective. They also, between their junior and senior summers, are asked to go on a six-week volunteer trip that by all accounts sounds very grueling. You know, one person told me he went to the Dominican Republic for 6 weeks and built a road by hand with no electricity.
Wow. We're speaking with Michelle Hackman, Wall Street Journal reporter. She's written a piece entitled "The All Boys High School Producing GOP Bigwigs." Was it a student or a teacher that you quoted in the story who said something along the lines of, if you're not going to take part academically, you got to take part physically?
Yes, it was a former student. I think the point he was making was that, you know, service takes many forms, and a lot of students end up going into the military. And he cited this sort of funny example where he said his French teacher, anytime someone had not done their homework and didn't know an answer to a question, that the French teacher would say, jump out the window and run some laps around the school. And kids kind of thought it was a joke, but he was like, no, I'm not kidding. You know, jump out of that window. And the point he was making was, you know, if you're not going to participate academically by doing your work, then you've got to, you know, participate some way or another.
Well, I know it's been some years, I guess, but any of the teachers that are still there recall having had, say, a Brett Kavanaugh in class or Neil Gorsuch?
Yes, I actually quoted a history teacher who has worked at the school for, he told me, 41 years, and he taught both Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch and described them both as really products of their school.
Thanks, Michelle. Wall Street Journal reporter Michelle Hackman. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Remember the relaxed Julys of years ago when you could wander around barefoot, grill hamburgers and hot dogs, and yep, even swim in some darned pond. Boston Globe columnist Alex Beam says now summer is like a set of permanently flashing hazard lights on your dashboard, suggesting danger, peril ahead. Get off the road and stay indoors till fall. Another hazard you didn't know about, by the way, corn on the cob. Alex, set this up.
I've been writing for the Globe for years, and New England summers are just utterly spectacular. Lots of wonderful outdoors activity. And if you're kind of a baby boomer like me, it's hard not to notice that all these things that you enjoyed in your own youth are now basically forbidden. I once wrote a column about how you can't tell ghost stories at camp anymore, which is quite shocking. Everyone knows that, you know, diving boards have been practically banned for a quarter century. And for this column, which may or may not have been called, like, Danger Summer Ahead, one of my reactions was, you know, the CDC in Atlanta, which is, of course, a completely credible source of information about hazards and diseases, basically put out this press release saying that every lake and stream that you might be bathing in is full of toxic bacteria, right. You know, and you're going to die. There's even stuff that I didn't put in this column, but which we could get to if you want. But I mean, like, again, this is sort of New England bias here. I mean, my beloved Globe has really gotten in the business. It's like it should be called the Boston Globe Shark Watch, because we regale our readers with these constant tales of sharks circling the unspeakably gorgeous Outer Cape, which I hope some of your listeners are familiar with. Yeah. And I mean, it's like, yeah, you wouldn't even set foot there if you read the newspapers these days.
We're speaking with Alex Beam, columnist at the Boston Globe. He's written a piece entitled Danger, Summer is Here. So, I mean, what else made your list? Because I know you ran through a number of things.
Part of it was I knew what I would find, right? Everyone, I mean, I didn't even bother writing about grilling, because grilling has been, you know, linked to carcinogenic substances on charred meat. So, I mean, I sort of gave grilling a pass. I actually have a family member who's sitting about 50 feet away from me who won't let her children go barefoot in the summer. And we're at a shared family facility here with beautiful lawns. You know, the idea, it kind of directly attacks a sort of an American culture that's been with us for 200 years. It goes back to Huck Finn, obviously. I mean, going barefoot is like what we want to do, but there's even CDC guidance on the inadvisability of going barefoot. Again, a lot of bacteria, hookworm, ringworm, etc.
Jeez.
in the ground. I mean, the thing I actually Googled, I mean, because I knew I would find, you know, foods not to eat in summer. And I was astonished to find watermelon, you know, on the list of foods you shouldn't eat because the seeds can become ensconced in your bowels grass and lead to God knows what. The one that totally freaked me out that I didn't mention in the column was corn on the cob. Cosmopolitan magazine published a list of foods that you should avoid in the summer, and literally my favorite, I happen to be speaking to you from New Hampshire, which has great corn that comes in August. This magazine said the corn on the cob, first of all, caused dental concerns because, like, you know, everyone knows how the little corn skins get in between your teeth, and that can eventually rot out your teeth, supposedly.
Oh, my goodness.
And then they said, it's too sugary. Corn on the cob is too sugary. I mean, anyway, yeah,
wow.
It's a nightmare.
Is there any list of things we can do? Maybe I'll just keep that in my back pocket.
Yeah. No, you've got to wait for fall. That's all you really can do. Just wait for fall and hope for the best.
Wow.
And stay away from diving boards. Jeez.
That is something. Man, the corn on the cob, I still can't even process. That's I thought you were going to say something about, you know, it might bang your teeth if you eat it like a typewriter or something like that, but yeah, I guess we don't floss, so we can never remove any of the stuff that gets lodged between our teeth. I don't know.
Right.
Wow.
No barefooting is kind of where I draw the line.
Right.
In any case, yes, I'm looking forward to fall when life becomes somewhat safer again. At least the sharks will go further north or south or wherever the heck
right.
The sharks go.
Thanks, Alex. Alex Beam, columnist at the Boston Globe. So keep that in mind, all right? Corn on the cob can get stuck between your teeth. And too much sugar, apparently. It's 20 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. Time for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. If you want to take your business to the top, take it to a top 10 most improved state for business, Michigan. Contact michiganbusiness.org today. A bank executive is trying to wildly change your perception of traditional banks. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
When you think of bankers, you probably think of staid men in suits. Well, there's at least one banker who's trying to change that image. Christina Rexroad of the Wall Street Journal is here with more. Christina, let's start with the bank itself. What can you tell us about Berkshire Hills Bancorp?
Yeah, so this is a tiny little bank. They've been based in the Berkshires in Massachusetts for a long time. They recently just moved to Boston, so they're trying to get a higher profile. But, you know, unless you're really covering the industry or unless you live in that area, you've probably never heard of them. You know, my job is I cover regional and community banks, and so my job is to just sort of talk to people, see who's out there. And one of the reasons this bank caught my eye is because they have this funny tagline, or they call themselves America's most exciting bank, which is sort of, you know, gimmicky and funny. But that's also, in banking, that's particularly unusual because, you know, most banks right now want to be pretty boring and fly under the radar.
And Christina, they get that from their CEO, Michael Daly. What can you tell us about him?
I first met him when I got lunch with him. He's very confident. He, you know, runs this small little bank and thinks that he can take on much bigger players. And he is, you know, pretty unusual in that the best example you're ever going to find of this man, unless he tops it, is, he had an employee meeting some years ago and he rode into it on a zip line and, you know, had a smoke machine, was like tossing $100 bills to the crowd. So you're not going to find that in many business executives, much less bankers. And, you know, and then for all that, he doesn't really have a traditional background, you know, because a lot of people who are bankers maybe always thought they would be or always liked numbers. And he strikes me as more of a people person.
We're speaking with Christina Rexroad of the Wall Street Journal. Christina, what does Michael Daly want Berkshire Hills to look like, the bank itself? Or what are the rules that he set for his employees to make it different?
Yeah, so he has these kind of funny rules. Like, you have to play rock music at the start of every meeting. And, it has to be rock music. It can't be elevator music. You know, it's sort of strict like that. You know, he doesn't wear a suit. He doesn't want other people to wear a suit. And his philosophy, and I don't really know if you can prove whether this is successful or not, or if you just have to rely on anecdotal evidence, is that people will do better work if they, you know, want to come to the office. And you know, I mean, that's not an original thought. A lot of people have, like, tech companies and so forth try to exhibit that too.
Do you know if his employees like him?
I don't know. We just did a short little feature on him. So I am sure that there are employees who sort of rolled their eyes and thought that this was silly and probably left, you know, because there's a lot of other banks that you can work for. But something he told me he does, which I have, you know, not met anyone else who does this, is that he says that he writes 200 or 300 handwritten notes to employees every month. And I mean, you know, he has fewer than 2,000 employees. So if you're an employee, you're going to get a note from him at least once a year. You know, he said he writes them if somebody gets hired or somebody has a death in the family. And again, I mean, these things are really hard to measure, right? And companies have gone back and forth for years on the merits of being a friendly workplace. But, you know, for certain people, I imagine that getting a handwritten note from the CEO every once in a while really does mean a lot. I've never worked for a company where I got a handwritten note from the CEO. So.
And Christina, what are Daly's goals as a CEO for his bank?
This is not all that unusual, but he wants to keep growing, right? And this is a business where it's very hard to be a small bank, and it's very hard to stay your size. You almost have to be buying other banks if you want to survive. So he's done a lot of that. We'll see if he's able to continue to do so. And then, you know, he wants to expand the wealth management. He wants to expand commercial lending. Now, that's not all that unusual. Like a lot of other, you know, regional size banks, and a lot of banks his size, more community focused, also want to do more wealth management and more commercial lending.
That is this weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Christina Rexrode. It is 30 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. We'd like to welcome a new sponsor to the show, Untuck It. You know, it's never a good look when you untuck a long, bulky dress shirt. Untuck It makes shirts specifically designed to be worn untucked. A casual shirt that's not too long and not too short. It's just right. And not only do they look good, they feel great. And if you're a woman, by the way, wishing you can have one of these, well, Untuck It now makes shirts for women, too. Log on to untuckit.com and check out all the new arrivals. Use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% off your entire purchase. You can also visit one of Untuck It's over 25 retail locations across the country. Untuckit.com, your solution to perfecting casual. Use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% savings. Again, untuckit.com and use the promo code GORDONDEAL for 20% savings. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Coming up this half hour, the men who are obsessed with their lawn care and a profile of the world's most traveled man. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. Is it time to forget the picket fence and 2.5 kids? Something we once referred to as the American Dream. Financial advisor Gary Surok thinks so. He's written a book called The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. Gary, what are you hearing?
Gordon, when I was writing the book, I interviewed 25 people from all across the country, and I asked them that question if their dream had changed, and they all started laughing and said, oh yeah, you know, my first dream was to figure out how to feed my family. But the more they progressed and succeeded and achieved what they were achieving, the dream was totally a moving target. So I believe in that. I think it is a moving target.
Okay, so it changes with age or phases in life, not because we're down and out and we've given up on things?
I think it changes with phases and ages, and I think all of that. I think, we change mentally. I think there are people that give up, and they're clearly never going to achieve it, because one of the key points when I wrote the book, and it was funny that I only wrote 13 chapters of people, but I interviewed 25, but all of them had the same point when it was over, that if they had just bailed out on their failure, none of this would have ever happened. And they just refused to quit. It was just such a critical point in the book. It really, truly is.
I was disappointed, by the way. I saw this Fast Company survey, and I know you reference it in your notes here about how a lot of people feel that retirement these days is basically unattainable. Why do we have that approach?
I think because the traditional system of pension plans is gone. Now we're in 401ks, and now we're left to our own devices. And most people are not very good at solving their own financial problems. they aren't very good at saving money. In fact, I was just with a client of mine yesterday, and we're having this discussion. His staff, he said, they live paycheck to paycheck. And he said, Gary, it doesn't matter what I pay them. They're still living paycheck to paycheck. He said, if it's $40,000, they're one way. If they're $70,000, it's the same thing. He said, it's crazy. They're not saving any money. I think that's where the fear comes from.
Wow. Have millennials changed the equation here when it comes to the American dream? They don't seem to be into home ownership as much, or maybe they can't afford it.
You know, Gordon, that's an interesting point. The millennials I meet with, they're mostly not interested in owning a home. They really like their apartment living. They like the fact that they're not responsible for anything, that they don't have any maintenance to do. It's a different mindset.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I guess that's where I'm thinking the American dream is evolving again, because there's this whole generation that doesn't really want to own homes. So I think the American dream of, you know, I'm going to own a home, have a dog, go on vacation, and have two cars and you know, 2.5 kids, isn't really going to work anymore. I think the new generation is saying, hey, I'm okay with having an apartment and living in the city or living where they're living.
Well, we're speaking with Gary Sirak, financial advisor, also author of a book called The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. And we're talking about how the American dream has changed. So you referenced 401ks these days and how they have replaced the traditional pension plan. Do you think that we are in some sort of adjustment period and eventually we'll all be in the habit of saving on our own for retirement?
I think that that's a critical component. I work with a lot of retired people because I've been doing this a while, Gordon. So I have all these people coming in about 3 a week now, which is kind of astounding to me. But that's what's happening. People are walking in the door, and we're talking about their assets and where do they stand. And there's a solid group that never really got into the swing of putting money away in the 401k. They just didn't believe in it for whatever reason. And they're in trouble. They're going to have to keep working. Then there's an element where they actually participated, and they've done very well. And they're certainly with Social Security and retirement, their 401k, they're going to be fine. And then there's an element where people are just massive savers. And not only did their 401k, but they did other things. And those people, I mean, they paid off their house and their cars. They're great. They're going to be in great position financially, no question about it. It comes down to personal preferences. So I think we're going to have to save money because that's the way the system works. And we're just going to have discipline, which not very many people have, unfortunately.
True that. Thanks, Gary. It's Gary Sirak. The book is called The American Dream Revisited, Ordinary People, Extraordinary Results. It's 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Ordinarily, insurance companies would not be the most interesting topic, but there is one thing about them that's worth your attention. They have stood the business test of time. Outside the U.S., in fact, many go back as far as the 1600s. Adam Grossman, founder of Mayport Wealth Management, wrote on HumbleDollar.com that it's no coincidence that so many insurance companies have survived for so long. And he believes it's worth taking the time to understand the secret to their longevity in order to help your own finances. Adam, how do you see it?
What first got me thinking about this, Gordon, was actually my father-in-law. So my father-in-law is 95 years old. And when I first met him, you know, he was merely 75 years old. And he would give me lots of advice, and I would probably listen with one ear like any son-in-law. But as he got older, I realized that, you know, he's really stood the test of time, and I should probably start listening much more closely to his advice, particularly his health and nutritional advice. So now he's 95, and I listen very carefully to what he says. Similarly, insurance companies, it struck me, a lot of them are disproportionately represented among some of the oldest companies in the world. You know, maybe you've heard of Lloyd's of London. Mm-hmm. They've been around since the 1700s. But even in the U.S., you know, Cigna was founded during George Washington's administration. John Hancock was founded during the Civil War. And so it struck me that maybe these companies are doing something similar, that it's not just a coincidence that these companies have stood the test of time so well. And so that's why I feel like we really can benefit by studying what they do. And it's pretty clear, actually, what they do.
All right, so explain that. What is it that they do?
So the secret to their success, it's a little bit of a jargony term. It's known as liability matching. So I'll explain it in plain English. What they do is that they don't leave anything to chance. So to the best of their ability, they project out all the dollars that they think they'll have to pay out in the future. And they have teams of people who do forecasts, and they're known as actuaries, and they can estimate, you know, how many house fires and hurricane damage and so forth. And then they set aside dollars for each of those future claims that they think they'll have to pay out. And so you know, each of the claims is known as a liability, and so that's what they're matching. They're matching dollars to expected claims. So that is what allows them, you know, more or less to stay in business for so long, because they really don't just sort of hope there will be enough money to pay the claims, but they really try and plan it out.
Mm. All right, so that could translate to our own personal finances. How?
Well, you know, each of us does a form of this, which is that we save in 401ks for retirement. We might save in 529 accounts for college. And, of course, you know, day-to-day checking accounts we use for day-to-day expenses. So, in a sense, we do some form of matching. But I think where individuals maybe could take this step further is to say, let's actually look at the amount of dollars that are in each of those accounts and make sure that they match up to the future expense. So, for example, you know, I work with people who say, I put $1,000 a month into a 529 account for my four-year-old son. And I say, that's great, but have we done the math to figure out whether that's enough or maybe that's too much? And so I think that that's the exercise that can be very helpful.
Thanks, Adam. Adam Grossman, founder of Mayport Wealth Management, writing for HumbleDollar.com. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Hey, glad you're with us. For most people, though, there are plenty of other things we'd rather be doing than tackling the lawn. But for others, cutting the grass is an obsession to the point where they must have dark emerald green and preferably striped lawns. In addition, edges must be perfectly squared. The job isn't finished until the last weed is plucked and the final blade of grass blasted off the sidewalk. Wall Street Journal reporter Bob Haggerty found some of these obsessive types. Bob, who are these guys?
Most people, I think, consider lawn care to be just an annoying chore or something that they pay other people to do. But for these guys, it's a challenge.
I knew that there were some folks who were obsessive, of course, but there was one guy in there, I forget where he was from, he talked about cutting the grass 2 to 3 times a week.
Yeah. Some of the wives say, why are you cutting the grass? It looks fine already. But yeah, a lot of them cut 2 or 3 times a week. One of the guys I talked to, he mows the entire surface twice each time he mows, just because he likes uniformity. And then if there's any rogue blades of grass sticking up, he'll pull them out by hand.
In an above-ground pool, that would be an absolute nightmare for these guys.
Oh yeah, that's totally out of the question. Yeah, no of those blow-up pools. But some of them will let their kids walk around in the backyard. But one of the mothers told me that her husband, while he would let the kids play in the backyard, they couldn't stand in one place. They had to keep moving around.
Oh, my goodness.
And when some friends came over, they kind of teased him by lingering on the lawn a little bit longer than necessary for a group picture. Got it kind of matted down. So he came out with his leaf blower and fluffed the grass back up.
Wow. Man. What drives people like this?
Well, part of it is I think they find lawn care to be relaxing, and it's something that they can control in this world where there's very little we can control. Mm. One of them told me, you know, I sit in my office and stare at a computer all day, and at the end of the day, I ask myself what I got done. I can't really think of anything. But when he goes home and works on his lawn, he can see tangible results there.
Right.
It's also a good way to get outside. You know, you have an excuse to be out there. You're not just lazing around. And you meet your neighbors. They come over and ask you, how did you do that? Well, how come your lawn looks so much better than mine?
Wow. We're speaking with Bob Haggerty, Wall Street Journal reporter. He's written a funny story entitled Plucking Blades by Hand and Vacuuming the Grass. This is extreme lawn care. There's like kind of one guy on YouTube that a lot of them get helpful hints from.
That's right. His name is Alan Hain. He likes to talk about dominating your neighborhood, sort of putting the neighbors to shame. He calls it the line between your lawn and your neighbor's lawn is called the domination line.
That's funny.
And he'll even show you how you can rig up your fertilizer spreader so that you don't get any fertilizer on the neighbor's lawn. You can keep a very clean line so your grass is healthy and theirs is unhealthy, yellowish stuff.
The secrets to, like, those great pattern lines is a roller they drag behind the lawnmower?
You can buy an attachment for your lawnmower or you can make one.
What's it made of, do you know?
Well, I think usually they're made out of some kind of a metal bar, and it just rolls behind the grass, and it angles the grass one way or the other.
Yeah.
And then there's an effective light on your lawn that shows up those stripes.
Thanks, Bob. Wall Street Journal reporter Bob Haggerty. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. A guy named Don Parrish, maybe the world's most well-traveled man. He's already seen every country and territory on the globe. But he isn't ready to pack his bags and head home just yet. Mr. Parrish has become one of 23 people to have traveled to the 325 countries and territories total on the Travelers Century Clubs list, and that includes all 193 UN countries. In addition, he's voyaged more than 1,000 places on the Nomad Mania list, which keeps track of the accomplishments of the world's most traveled people. The Sun reports that the 73-year-old Mr. Parrish was also awarded the title of the world's most well-traveled man after a trip to Conway Reef, a small atoll 280 miles off the coast of Fiji. He started in 1965. You're thinking, geez, how does the guy afford it? Well, he says a lot of skimping and not saving. He told The Sun he lives frugally, no smoking, no coffee, drives old cars, but he has spent his life savings. Oh, and still on his to-do list, the Bounty Islands, the Scott Islands, and the Paracel Islands, wherever they are. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.